Well, I wonder what you make of that chapter. I'm going to ask you a very, very big question tonight. What is the meaning of life? What is the meaning of life? Over the last couple of weeks, we've seen this preacher of this book of Ecclesiastes try to answer this fundamental question. And I think he would frame it a bit like this. If this life is all that there is, then what's its meaning? If this life is all that there is, what is its meaning? And you know what? The shocking answer that he gives back, it's meaningless. Meaningless. Everything is meaningless, he says. And he's tried to test this out for himself. He's tried to say, well, listen, why don't I live the way that people long to live? So let's live for great pleasure and see what happens. Or let's live and do great works and see what happens. And he came back and he said to us, that's meaningless too. And sometimes he's just examined the way other people have lived their lives. Sometimes he's asked really tough questions. Why is it that people seem to spend all their time trying to earn a living and then never seem to enjoy it? It just seems meaningless. It's pointless, he says. You know, over the past couple of weeks, this preacher has looked at every facet of people's lives, every way, in every direction that they've lived. And he's coming back to this same problem. He's looked at their lives with this agenda to say, well, what is the meaning if this life is all that there is? And he keeps coming back with this same point. It's just meaningless. That's quite a terrible thing to actually say, isn't it? But that's his contention. So by the time he gets to chapter 8, in fact, it started in chapter 7, he starts saying, listen, if you are going to live life as if this is all that there is, if you are going to live life like that, well, can I at least give you some common sense wisdom? And he appeals to us. And the first thing he says is, listen, if you are going to live life like, as if this is all there is, at least live wisely. Choose wisdom. Choose wisdom and live wisely. And so he starts by singing the praise of what a wise man is. He says, who's like a wise man? Verse 1. Who can work out the meaning of things? The one who knows what life's really about. There's something about that kind of a guy, isn't there? You know him because he stands out from the crowd. He just knows the right things to do at the right time. His face kind of shines. He's the kind of person who life just hasn't haggard him down. He's just that little bit more together. And he's kind of saying, wouldn't you like to be that kind of person? Wouldn't that be the kind of person you want to be? Someone who life just seems to have a lot of meaning to. So here's some practical, common sense wisdom that such a wise man would apply. He says, why don't you keep in with the law as much as you are able? Keep in with the law as much as you are able, verse 2. Obey the king's command, I say, because you took an oath before God. You know, the king represents the authority in the land. And in all societies, there's a kind of implicit understanding that you've got to keep the law. You've got to obey the authority. Now, in the days of the preacher, you would have to swear an oath of allegiance before God to the king. In fact, you still have to do that now. I can tell you from personal experience that if you want to become a British citizen, you have to go to a special kind of lawyer called a notary, and you have to swear an oath of allegiance to the Queen, or at least promise that you will. So the teacher says, well, listen, since you promised that to God, you better keep to it. Don't be quick to stand against it, which, by which he's implying, listen, don't, that's what he's saying when he's saying, don't leave the king's presence. Because if you do that, if you break the law, well, you'll incur the full wrath of the law, won't you? The force of the law, whether it's wielded by a despot king, or whether it's wielded by a court in a democratic country, well, it's supreme. And you are just a single person. You know, sometimes we hear prosecutors use this phrase. They kind of say, we will bring the full weight of the law against them. And you have that kind of mental image, don't you? That kind of cartoon image of a little man who's standing there and there's a giant anvil and it falls on top of him. And that's the point that he's trying to make here. That you are nothing against that supreme authority. So he says, don't be in a hurry to leave the king's presence. Don't stand up for that bad cause. For the king will do what he pleases. Since the king's word is supreme, who can say, what are you doing? You have no power against the real authority, is his point. So it's best that you keep on the good side of the law. It's just some common sense wisdom, isn't it? Okay. But what happens if you live in a country where the king is not particularly good, or smart, or wise? What happens if you live in a country where the laws of the land are not just, they're unjust? What do you do then? You know, strangely enough, the advice that the wise man would give is that you still carry out this same principle. In fact, it's shown in different parts of the Bible that this is exactly the case. Daniel, for instance. Daniel was taken captive, wasn't he, into a pagan land. And he had to decide what things he wouldn't fight against, even though they were against his faith, and what things he would have to take a stand on. And in the New Testament, 1 Peter says, submit yourselves for the Lord's sake to every authority instituted among men, whether to the king, who as the supreme authority, or to governors who are sent to punish those who do wrong and commend those who do right. Peter said that. Peter said that to Christians at the time when the king was Nero. Nero, whose idea of a good laugh was to round up Christians, put them in his back garden and set them alight for his garden party. No, the preacher says to you, be wise, because even if you live in a harsh environment, there are ways and means of doing things. And a wise man uses his wits. He kind of sizes up the whole perilous situation that he's in, and he knows the right actions to take at the right times. So be wise, says the teacher. Be wise if you're going to live under the sun. See, there is a right way and a right time for all things, even in times of misery, even when you're living under an unjust ruler. And in this, he's kind of harping back to what he said earlier on in chapter 3, when he talked about the fact that everything has its season. In chapter 3, verse 1, he said, there's a time for everything, a season for every activity. Only when he was talking about that, he was just addressing the fact that, listen, things just keep going on and on and on, and there's a right time for everything. And what he was longing for in that circumstance, he was longing for something of permanence. Here he's longing for something predictable, something that you can be certain of. Because look what he says in verse 7. He says, since no man knows the future, who can tell him what's to come? How do you know what's coming up in the future? I wish I could tell you what the future holds. But you know what? The most awful truth is that if you live your life under the sun, if you live your life saying, this is all there is, the only thing you know for certain that's coming in the future, it's death. And I know that sounds very dark. I know that sounds like not something that's very hopeful. But when you shape your life to say this is all there is, that's what you do. You automatically cut out hope. And I wish that was the end of all that he had to say, but it gets worse. Because he says it's not just inevitable that death is coming to you. He says you're absolutely powerless over it. So in verse 8 he says, listen, no man has power over the wind to contain it. So no man has power over the day of his death. That word wind is the same word for spirit. And I believe that the wind he's talking about is the wind of your spirit. So he's expressing the fact that you are powerless to hold on to your life, to your spirit, as it were, within your body, no matter how hard you try. When you're about to die, there's nothing that you can do about it. I'm a big fan of medical dramas, ER, casualty, that sort of thing. I love them. And often in those kind of dramas, you will see that there's, you know, a person who's fatally wounded and they're passing away. And the hero or whoever it is usually doing CPR and they're pumping on their heart. And then often you'll hear they'll say, hold on. You ever seen that? And it's as if they're shouting to this person whose life is passing away, hold on. As if somehow the person who's dying, by the very will that he has, can hold on to his life. But you know that's just not true. He can't. And that's the point that the preacher's making. And just as you are powerless to hold on to your life, so you are powerless over the very day of your death either. No matter how healthy a lifestyle you live. Friends, you could be the fittest, healthiest person around. You could take all the precautions that you want, but you know that you could be in the wrong place at the wrong time. And that's it. And everybody must face this battle. Everybody must face the prospect of death. And the preacher says to you, if you think that wisdom won't save you, well then wickedness, the very opposite of wisdom in this chapter, certainly won't save you. And why does he mention wickedness? Well, because that's the alternative way of living. So his second appeal to you is this. Don't choose wickedness. Don't choose wickedness despite the contrary evidence. And he'll explain this over from verse 9 to verse 13. The preacher kind of takes a breather. And he said he considers all things under the sun. And he sees that the alternative way to living wisely is living wickedly. And there's plenty of that around. You know, it's ironic the way he writes this because he says, it's strange. We have no real power over authority, yeah, the king. We have no power over our death. We have no power even over the day of our death. But we have lots of power over other people to inflict pain on them. Isn't that odd? So let's look at the way the wicked live, he says. Let's look at their lot, he says. And he stands at the graveside of a wicked man. And what he sees is just disturbing. He sees that a wicked people seem to get away with it. So look at verse 10. Then too I saw the wicked buried, those who used to come and go from the holy place and receive praise in the city where they did this. This too is meaningless. I watched them go into the holy temple, he says, But no lightning struck them down. No curse had, you know, came upon them because of their wickedness. No, instead they left the temple and they went out and they were praised by men. People admired them. Even when they died, people still admired them. And if you think that was something of a yesteryear, let me tell you a really shocking thing that you probably know. But let me bring it, something to bring it up to date. Today, there are many Russians who see Joseph Stalin as a hero. Joseph Stalin. Why do you think that is? I think some people think, well, listen, although he might have been evil, at least he got things done. You might have heard this when people talk to you. You know, they look at people who weren't particularly good and they say, well, he might have bent the rules a little bit, but you've got to admire his tenacity. You've got to admire him. You know, he wasn't going to be beaten by the system. He got things done. And the preacher says this too is meaningless. You see, the corroding effect of this is that when you see that there's a delay between the sentencing of evil, when you see that people seem to get away with it, people's hearts just swell up with evil thoughts. Well, if that person can get away with it, well, maybe so can I. If they're going to get away with doing that, well, I can get away with something, can't I? And it's at this point that the preacher, who's kind of been acting like a kind of neutral observer and saying to you, well, let's look really at whether or not life has any meaning. He kind of just drops that mask that he has and he literally screams out, no, no, I've got to make a judgment on this. I've got to tell you that it is better to live wisely than to live, you know, wickedly. I've got to tell you that you have to remember your Creator. So look what he says. This is the key point of the whole chapter, and look how he says it in verses 12 and 13. Although the wicked man commits 100 crimes and still lives a long time, I know that it will go better with God-fearing men who are reverent before God. Yet because the wicked do not fear God, it will not go well with them, and their days will not lengthen like a shadow. You see the sharp contrast and the judgment that he makes in these two verses? It will go well with those who fear God. It will not go well with the wicked. And at one level, maybe he's expressing judgment when looked at from the position of what happens after death. Because you see, there must be justice. And God is a just God. And you know that to be true. Because in your heart, you automatically know about justice. One of the strangest things that happened to me, I noticed it, is that when my daughter was very young, one of the first things that she was saying, once she could start speaking, was, it's not fair. Ever heard that before? Where did children get that idea? It's not fair. It's something innately inside them. We are built for justice. That's why. And God has appointed Jesus Christ to be the judge of every person in this world. Only God's verdict is that we are all guilty. We've all fallen short of His glory. All fallen short of what He designed us to be. And you either let Jesus take your punishment for your sin, or you will have to take it yourself. It's really just that simple. So maybe, it's that the preacher is expressing this view that in the end, it will be well for those who fear God, and it will not be well for those who are wicked. But maybe also, he's expressing a general principle. That even if you live life as if there is no God, even if you live life under the sun, as it were, in general, even though the odd man can commit a multitude of sins against God and seems to get away with it, he seems to live a good long life, has lots of success, is praised by men. In general, wicked men get their comeuppance. They don't live long, successful lives. They get caught up in their wickedness. And the proof of that, how many gangster drug dealers do you know who make it to old age? Now, I know that you may not know that many gangster drug dealers. But you understand the principle, though, don't you? A life that is marked by wickedness is usually a life that is cut short. Oh yes, there will be the exception. There will be anomalies. But that's the general rule. So reject wickedness is what he says. Reject that way. Despite evidence to the contrary. Despite the odd anomaly. But the problem is that life just isn't straightforward. It doesn't come in nice, neat packages. It's not be wise and have a good life and be wicked and suffer the consequences. It's just a lot like that. Sometimes the oddest of anomalies happen. Verse 14, look, a righteous man gets what the wicked deserve and a wicked man gets what the righteous deserve. And it seems so frustrating. If you consider that this life is all that there is. I mean, why? Why do bad things happen to good people? Even if it's not the norm, why does it happen at all? And he doesn't give you an answer. No, he says, if you consider that this is all there is to life, then the best that I can tell you to do is simply to enjoy the simple pleasures of life. Eat, drink. In the midst of the hard drudgery of this life, just enjoy what God gives you. Because you don't know whether blessing or whether misery is right round the corner. That's all he can offer you. And then he makes his final appeal. He says, who can make sense of this life? Here's the third point. Who can make sense of it? Let's grab this bull by the horns, really. Let's ask the real question. What's the meaning of life? How do we really live life right? You see, hard work and simple living, well, it can only really shelve the deep questions of life. It can't solve them. And all of our work, all of our busyness, what does it all mean anyway? And the preacher's answer to you is both humbling and hopeful. And it's in these last two verses. Verse 16. When I applied my mind to know wisdom and to observe man's labor on earth, his eyes not sleeping day or night, then I saw all that God has done. No one can comprehend what goes on under the sun. Despite all his efforts to search it out, man cannot discover its meaning. Even if a wise man claims that he knows, he cannot really comprehend it. The very fact that we question what life is for, that though we seem compelled to live a life of busyness and work and things carrying on day after day after day, but yet we want to know why and what does this all mean. The fact that we question it is an indicator to you and to anybody that there is more to this life than just what you see. You know, back in chapter 3, in verse 11, he said, God had planted eternity in the human heart, But even so, people cannot see the whole scope of God's work from beginning to end. And so here also, it's the same sort of thing. We know there must be meaning to all of this life, but we just can't grasp it. And you know why? Because the answer is, it's God's work. And none of us has the capacity to understand it. No one can discover everything God is doing under the sun. It's God's work. The whole meaning of life, with all its complications and its injustices, with all its joys and its times and its seasons, all of it, it's not just that God can make sense of it, it's that the whole world is made for God. And He is the one who's redeeming it. So you can't make sense of this life if you think that this life is all that there is. So who can? Well, let me tell you this. You can come to the one who can make sense of it. Of course you can. Come to the one person who offers you rest, peace for your soul, hope, certainty. Without God, there is only the certainty of death. With Jesus, there is the certainty of hope and everlasting life on this earth, with no pain, with no suffering, with no sickness, with no more death, just perfect relationship between God and you and between His people. And how can you be sure? If someone asks you, how can you be sure of this certainty? Because Jesus is the one person who doesn't fit the mold of the man described here. Jesus is the one person who lived in perfect wisdom. He makes sense of life. He's the one who has power to retain His Spirit. Remember He said, I have the power to lay down my life and to take it back up again. He's the one who had power over the day of His death. Remember He's the one who said, we're going up to Jerusalem, and when we get there, then the Son of Man will be killed. He knew exactly when He was going to die. And how can we know for certain all the good things that Jesus promises? Eternal life, forever living with God. How can you know for certain? Because He rose from the dead. He showed you that He has mastery over death, not the other way round. That's how you know for certain. So, will you come? Come to the person who can make sense of life and come and live for Him, because that's real wisdom. This passage asks you to choose wisdom, not wickedness. And true wisdom brings you to Jesus.